Welcome to the No Illusions podcast for February 23rd, 2011. My name is Cameron Riley. This is No Illusions, the news that you need to know. Coming up in a little while, I have a guest, my first guest for the year, Anthony Lowenstein. Anthony's been on the show before, anthonylowenstein.com, author of the books My Israel Question, The Blogging and The Blogging Revolution, I should say. It's not one title. Well-known commentator and journalist, independent journalist in Australia, who writes a lot about what's happening in the Middle East. Anthony's going to be joining me. We're going to be talking about, obviously, all of the news that's been coming out of the Middle East for the last month or so. I'm really looking forward to that. First of all, just want to get started with an interesting article I read this morning. It's on opendemocracy.net. What has WikiLeaks ever taught us? Now, you'll often hear the mainstream media and government officials saying, well, there's nothing new in Wikipedia stuff. It's all old news. They try and pass it off as being unnecessary and not really revealing anything new. And they can get away with that a lot of the time because they know that we don't know the difference. Of course, they can say it with a straight face because a lot of it may not be news to them, but it's certainly news to the rest of us. Here's a list, a collection of some of the things that WikiLeaks has made public for the first time. Let's see if you think these things are important and worth protecting. American planes bombed a village in southern Yemen in December 2009, killing 14 women and 21 children. The Secretary of State's office encouraged U.S. diplomats at the United Nations to spy on their counterparts by collecting biographic and biometric information. The Obama administration worked with Republicans to protect Bush administration officials facing a criminal investigation into torture. A U.S. Army helicopter gunned down two Reuters journalists in Baghdad in 2007. U.S. authorities failed to investigate hundreds of reports of abuse, torture, rape, and even murder by Iraqi police and soldiers. In Iraq, there were scores of claims of prison abuse by coalition forces even after the Abu Ghraib scandal. Afghan President Hamid Karzai freed suspected drug dealers because of their political connections. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu expressed support for the concept of land swaps. The United States was secretly given permission from Yemen president to attack the Al-Qaeda group in his country. Then Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld and his top commanders repeatedly knowingly lied to the American public about rising sectarian violence in Iraq beginning in 2006. The U.S. was shipping arms to Saudi Arabia for use in northern Yemen even as it denied any role in the conflict. Saudi Arabia was one of the largest origin points for funds supporting international terrorism. A storage facility housing Yemen's radioactive material was unsecured for up to a week. Israel destroyed a Syrian nuclear reactor in 2007, fearing it was built to make a bomb. Top officials in several Arab countries have close links with the CIA. And of course, we've got more news coming up today that you've probably seen already over the last couple of days about this CIA operative that's being charged with murder in Pakistan. I'll get Anthony to comment on that. Swiss company Trafigura Bahia BV dumped toxic waste at the Iberian port of Abidjan, then attempted to silence the press from revealing it by obtaining a gagging order. Pakistan's government has allowed members of its spy network to hold strategy sessions on combating American troops with members of the Taliban. A stash of highly enriched uranium capable of providing enough material for multiple dirty bombs has been waiting in Pakistan for removal by an American team for more than 3 years. U.S. military special operations forces have been conducting offensive operations inside Pakistan despite repeated U.S. denials. Again, more on that later on. China was behind the online attack on Google. North Korea is secretly helping the military dictatorship in Myanmar build nuclear and missile sites in its jungles. The Indian government condones torture and systematically abused detainees in the disputed region of Kashmir. The British government has been training a Bangladeshi paramilitary force condemned by human rights organisations as a government death squad. BP suffered a blowout after a gas leak in the Caucasus country of Azerbaijan in September 2008, a year and a half before another BP blowout killed 11 workers. Saudi Arabia's rulers have deep distrust for some fellow Muslim countries, especially Pakistan and Iran. Saudi Arabia's King Abdullah repeatedly urged the United States to attack Iran. Iranian Red Crescent ambulances were used to smuggle weapons to Lebanon's militant Hezbollah group during its 2006 war with Israel. Dozens of US tactical nuclear weapons are in Germany, the Netherlands, and Belgium. The Libyan government promised enormous repercussions for the UK if the release of Abdel Basset el-Megrahi, the Lockerbie bomber, was not handled properly. We're going to have more on Libya, obviously, today. Pope Benedict impeded an investigation into alleged child sex abuse within the Catholic Church. Sinn Féin leaders Gerry Adams and Martin McGuinness carried out negotiations for the Good Friday Agreement with Irish then Prime Minister Bertie Ahern, while the two had knowledge of a bank robbery the Irish Republican Army was planning to carry out. Anglo-Dutch oil giant Royal Dutch Shell PLC has infiltrated the highest levels of government in Nigeria. A US official was told by Mexican President Felipe Calderon that Latin America needs a visible US presence to counter Venezuelan President Hugo Chavez's growing influence in the region. Cuba's economic situation could become fatal within 2 to 3 years. McDonald's tried to delay the US government's implementation of a free trade agreement in order to put pressure on El Salvador to appoint neutral judges in a $24 million lawsuit it was fighting in the country. British officials made a deal with the US to allow the country to keep cluster bombs in the UK despite the ban on munitions signed by Gordon Brown. The British government promised to protect America's interests during the Chilcot inquiry into the Iraq war. The US government was acting on behalf of GM crop firm Monsanto in 2008 when the US embassy in Paris advised Washington to start a military-style trade war against any European Union country which opposed genetically modified crops. Pfizer tested antibiotics in Nigerian children, contravening national and international standards on medical ethics. Prisoners at Camp Delta in Guantanamo Bay were denied access to the Red Cross for up to 4 weeks. More than 66,000 civilians suffered violent deaths in Iraq between 2004 and the end of 2009. Russia is a virtual mafia state with rampant corruption and scant separation between the activities of the government and organized crime. The Obama administration tried to sweet-talk other countries into taking Guantanamo detainees as part of its as-yet unsuccessful effort to close the prison. They're just some of the stories that have been revealed by WikiLeaks over the course of the last 6 to 12 months. Which the mainstream media and government officials will tell you nothing new, nothing important has come out of WikiLeaks. It's just a bunch of diplomatic gossip. I call bullshit on that one. Well, I'm joined now by somebody who's been on the show a few times before, somebody who I like to follow on Twitter, follow his blog, author, independent journalist, Anthony Lowenstein. Welcome to the show, mate.
Thanks for having me.
Now, you predicted, of course, all of this, the blogging revolution. When did you write that, 2008, 7?
Yes, well, it came out 2008, was in the Middle East for that book, 2007. And remarkably, I'm not going to say I predicted it all, but a lot of the people who I spoke to in Egypt and others, in fact, are now some of the key people involved in the revolutions in lots of the Middle East. So no one, of course, predicted exactly what was going to happen, how it was going to happen. Nobody did. No one could. But I think it's amazing to be alive in truly revolutionary times.
I mean, for people who haven't read your book, the Blogging Revolution, as I recall, the theme of it was how people in, let's say dictatorships and other countries that where they have less media and political freedoms than we have in the West were using social media to undermine those regimes and to bypass, circumvent the restrictions on media and on political gathering. And that's exactly, I mean, you know, we hear a lot of talk in the press about this being the Facebook revolution or the Twitter revolution happening in Tunisia and Egypt and now Libya and Bahrain and these places. But, I mean, obviously there's a lot more to it than that. These are movements that have been going for decades, but seem to have been using these tools to help organize and coordinate. You were really on the money, mate. You saw it coming down the line. I think you need to take some credit for that.
Well, wish I could say I was. Yes, thank you. Well, I guess the good news on the one hand is that the blogging revolution is currently being updated to be released shortly with all the current events. So I'd say the listeners hold that thought, and later on this year it's going to be released in a new edition, updated edition. I suppose I'd say 2 points on what you just said, Cameron. Firstly, that what's remarkable about what I wrote about in the book is, in fact, how little, in fact, I don't think Facebook and Twitter were basically even talked about. And this is what's extraordinary. At the time when I was researching, my recollection is that Twitter wasn't used at all and Facebook in a very, very small way. So really this has changed a lot in the last few years. Of course, it was mainly blogs and websites and email. One of the things I stressed in the book, and most of the people I spoke to, and this, of course, has been proven out in the last month or so, is that we have a sense, I think, very much in the West that, well, if countries like Egypt or Iran or whatever get the internet, that somehow Western-style democracy will follow. And I think one of the things that's become very clear in the last month, in fact, is how what's happened in these countries has happened despite Western US foreign policy, not because of it, despite of it. So clearly in Egypt, in Bahrain, indeed in Libya, the truth is that the US and indeed Australia in a smaller way and Britain had no desire for change. It was suiting their agenda incredibly well to maintain autocracies to serve their agendas in terms of oil or resources or backing Israel or whatever it may be. This is one of the things I think that people you speak to over there, and this has become much clearer in the last few months, real democracy and true democracy, in fact, threatens US foreign policy and threatens the position of Israel in that region very clearly, because the only way, in my view, Israel can maintain itself as a so-called democracy, and of course Israel's a democracy only for Jews, is with other states oppressing their own people. Because if there was real democracy in the Middle East, in Egypt, Jordan, etc., in all likelihood, and we'll see this in Egypt hopefully in the next 6-12 months when there are democratic processes, the people who are likely to be elected, or the leadership, or at least the politicians, are far less likely and less willing to maintain a siege on Gaza or support wars against Gaza as the Mubarak regime did, as one example. So there is a changing of the guard here, and you know that because if you read the Israeli press, many of the Jewish Zionist establishment are petrified that somehow democracy is sort of all very nice for those poor Arabs, but really how are we going to maintain the occupation? That's the kind of level of debate that's happening in Israel.
Yeah, I've been reading through Jerusalem Post this morning, getting a sense, and I know it's one of the more liberal.
No, the opposite.
Oh, that's right. Yeah, what's the liberal one over there?
Haaretz,
that's right, yeah. Now, I was reading some of the opinion pieces and commentary pieces in Jerusalem Post, and they're really quite scary. But, you know, I totally agree with you, and it's particularly about the US's position on what's been happening. It's been fascinating to watch the differences in the rhetoric coming out of the Obama administration, particularly from people like Hillary Clinton, when, you know, it's Egypt that is undergoing this versus Iran, you know, when they had their troubles a year or so ago and they're having more today, or her rhetoric against Gaddafi in Libya. Very, you know, much more extreme rhetoric coming out of the Obama administration when it's against people that aren't American puppet states, versus the ones that are, like Mubarak, as you said.
One of the things that's also very interesting about Gaddafi in Libya, though, which is has got some press in the last years, but not as much as it should. For decades, Gaddafi was an enemy of sorts of the West. He was seen as supporting terrorism. I mean, Saddam, of course, in Iraq was a supporter of terrorism as well, but he was our friend because he supported the war against Iran, which, of course, was seen in the West and remains so as the convenient bogeyman. But since roughly 2003-04, very soon after the Iraq war, Gaddafi was brought in from the cold. He was embraced by the Blair regime in Britain and indeed the Bush administration. There were deep relationships in terms of counterterrorism. Libya was involved in elements of rendition. Gaddafi was fated with business deals, and indeed Tony Blair, the great war criminal himself, in fact, became a very close advisor to Gaddafi and received money for doing so. So we have to really ask ourselves, whenever we talk about and we see Hillary Clinton prattling on about democracy or freedom or human rights, or indeed a lot of the criticism I've seen in the last days of the UN, for example, has indulged people like Gaddafi. There's elements of truth in that. The UN indulges many dictatorships around the world. But the reality is, of course, that many of the Western elites have benefited from an individual like Gaddafi being welcomed in from the cold, both in a business sense and a political sense. And now, of course, what's very clear is in the last few days, the leverage that Washington has over Gaddafi is not like Mubarak. I mean, Washington wasn't essentially, as you said before, funding the Libyan state at all. They had some business interests, some people in America did, but they weren't a client state of America like Egypt was. And therefore, I think what becomes very clear is that the relationship of a state like Libya to the US now is clearly not particularly tight. Gaddafi apparently thus far at least hasn't listened to anybody apart from, well, his sons. And I don't know if any of your listeners saw in the last 24 hours some of the media appearances that Colonel Gaddafi has had on Libyan TV. Quite mad and surreal. There was an image last night of him sitting in what looks like a film set in a car holding an umbrella. I don't know if anyone, do you see this?
I've seen some of it, and I was going to say, I mean, say what you like about the man, but he cuts a very dashing figure with his...
It really does. I mean, what's crazy about it is on Al Jazeera English last night, one of the anchors was saying, it's like it was out of a scene from Singing in the Rain. It was so odd and surreal. And, of course, one of the things that I think Gaddafi has used for a long time is that kind of eccentricity, so to speak. He was a dictator who brutalized his own people. Opposition didn't really exist. And what's been emerging in the last few weeks clearly has been opposition groups in the diaspora. But you have to be also very careful, though, that I think one of the things I talked about in the blogging book was often an over-reliance in the Western press to prescribe influence or power to opposition groups because they say what we want to hear. Now, this is not to minimize some of the Libyans who clearly fled Gaddafi's rule. They're in exile. Some of them have done wonderfully important work to try and keep the issue of Libya in the press and in the world. I'm not criticizing them for a second. What I'm simply saying is that there needs to be, I think, a degree of critical skepticism about the possible agendas of individuals who claim to be an opposition group. We shouldn't forget, of course, the classic example of opposition groups in Iraq.
Curveball.
Indeed. Curveball being the most infamous example. But, of course, there was also the case of the Iraqi National Congress, the INC, Ahmed Shalabi and others, who essentially very convincingly either gave a lot of false intelligence to both Western journalists in America and indeed the Bush administration to allegedly convince them to go to war in Iraq, and that was going to be wonderful, and they would then take over and we live happily ever after. Didn't quite work out that way, funnily enough. And I only use that example to suggest that it's important that when we look at, say, bloggers or people on Twitter or Facebook, as important as those voices are, we shouldn't exaggerate their influence, because in a place like Egypt, although many of the organizers, the younger organizers particularly, undoubtedly used Facebook and Twitter and text messages for that matter to organize, a lot of the people who are on the streets in Egypt in the last month don't use the internet at all. So there is, I think, often as you said a minute ago, a Western media obsession to dub every revolution as a Twitter revolution or a Facebook revolution. And I'm not minimizing the effects of those tools, but I'm saying we shouldn't exaggerate them either.
Yeah, I agree. And there's obviously, you know, a lot of organization that was going on and activist groups in Egypt and in all of these countries for a long, long time. Just getting back to Libya, I think it's interesting to think a little bit about some of the political realities of Libya. as you said, Colonel Gaddafi has been quite amusing. I mean, not amusing for the Libyans, obviously, that are getting shot. No. And, you know, apparently there's a report of a couple of Air Force personnel from Libya who have defected, saying they were given orders to bomb the city squares.
Yeah.
General Abdel Fattah Younis, Libya's interior minister, announced his resignation and support for what he called the February 17th revolution. But it's also, you know, interesting to keep in mind that Libya is one of the wealthiest countries in the world, GDP per capita, as a result of its very high oil revenues and you know, relatively small population. And you can imagine that the US has a lot to gain by regime change in Libya, and obviously they've been trying to get rid of Gaddafi for decades through means fair and foul, even though they removed him, as you pointed out earlier, from their list of states that sponsor terrorism back in about 2006, I think, when the Bush regime was making friends with Libya. They have a lot to gain by trying to get one of their own in there. And, you know, it's one of the challenges, obviously, for the people in all of these countries, even though, like, taking Egypt as an example, even though Mubarak is gone, it seems that it's really been the military that's been running Egypt since about 1952 anyway, and they're now running it again. Nothing much has changed. There's a lot of there's some talk that they're going to implement free and fair elections, but somehow I don't expect that to happen, do you?
Well, it's a real concern, and I think one of the things that many of the activists that I'm in touch with in Cairo and elsewhere, these are Egyptian activists, are worried that some of the momentum that was built up in the last month about deposing Mubarak, and that was obviously successful, I think far greater than they ever imagined in the amount of time it took, remarkably only 3 weeks, that the infrastructure of the military hasn't changed. In fact, nothing really has changed apart from Mubarak leaving. And there is a great deal of, I think, justified skepticism about whether real democratic reform will happen. I think what you've seen, though, in the last few weeks since Mubarak fell is a continuation of public protests and public activism in Egypt to try and maintain pressure on the Egyptian military to implement these changes. It is difficult, I have to admit, to really imagine them giving up power because, of course, the elephant in the room in all this with Egypt is US military aid. This, of course, is one of the key things that has allowed Mubarak and his regime to maintain itself for so many years. I mean, Egypt is the second highest recipient of US aid every year after Israel, roughly $1.3 to $2 billion annually, the vast majority of which goes to military means, etc. And, of course, we shouldn't also forget then the years after 9/11, and indeed before that as well, America sent countless so-called terror suspects to be tortured for so-called intelligence in Egypt, including Australian citizen Mamdouh Habib. So Egypt has been a very convenient staging post for acts that Western countries feel a bit squeamish about, but they'd like one of their allies to do it for them. And Australia is complicit in that as well, as we've seen in great detail over the case with Mamdouh Habib, who's now getting a massive compensation from the Gillard government, which is essentially an implied, in my view, acknowledgement that, in fact, he was tortured, as he said all along. But I think there's also a real question, I think, about clearly what comes next in all these Middle East countries. And Robert Fisk, who's done amazing work in the last few weeks, as he often does, he's been in Egypt and just in Bahrain, talking about how one of the great myths that we constantly hear in much of the Western press, particularly in neoconservative circles, but also just in the corporate press as well, is that there's a fear of an Islamist takeover of the Middle East. And, of course, this is one of the great myths that people like Mubarak has used for years, namely that if we don't remain in power, if you in the West don't keep me in power, Islamists are going to come on, take over our country and destroy Israel and stability will no longer exist. The truth is, of course, the opposite. That, yes, there are Islamist groups in Egypt and many Muslim, obviously, countries and Arab countries. But as Fisk has rightly said, a lot of the makeup of the protest movements in these countries has been secular. Not solely, but a lot of it's been secular. Various different groups, young, old, women, Christians, Muslims, etc. the role of Islamist groups clearly is an unknown question. I mean, the Muslim Brotherhood has influence in Egypt. No one quite knows exactly how much, but it certainly has influence. And I think one of the things that I've constantly been saying for a number of years, and I talk about in my blogging book as well, is that since 9/11, the narrative that's been created for us by, well, the Americans and indeed the Howard government and the Gillard government hasn't really changed that very much under Rudd as well, was that anyone who's an Islamist by definition somehow is the devil and we must avoid him or her and not talk to them, etc., which is lunacy. As if somehow that Al-Qaeda is the same as, say, Hezbollah, or the Muslim Brotherhood is the same as the Taliban. It's utterly, utterly untrue. And this is not to say that I often like a lot of what certain Islamists stand for. Would I want to live in a state under Sharia law? Absolutely not. No, I wouldn't personally. But that, what I think in some ways is beside the point. The point is that if the West believes in the concept of democracy and individuals who have the right to choose their own way of life, and the West and elites, of course, don't want and accept that, as we've seen for the last 60 years plus, then Islamists have to have a role. They represent a number of people in society, men and women. And indeed, there's been a fascinating coverage in the last few weeks in some of the smaller American press of the more liberal-minded Muslim Brotherhood figures in Egypt, men and women, many online, some of whom, in fact, feature in my book, who talk about the attempt to try and modernize the Brotherhood. Now, it's not to say that there are secular Egyptians that I know who, frankly, can't think of anything worse than the idea of having an Islamist government in Egypt. And that's a legitimate discussion to have, absolutely legitimate. But the idea somehow in the West that we need to try and stop Islamist forces taking over in a country if there's a democratic process is exactly the same mistake we've made for years, which has meant that in many of the protests in the last month across the Middle East, many people have clearly said America has had its influence in this region for decades and they've given us terror and anti-democratic forces enough. You know, please do not get involved anymore, bugger off, basically, which of course America won't do. But that's been the message. It hasn't been the main message, but it's most definitely been there.
Yeah, and David Cameron, the Prime Minister of England, had some interesting words to say about this very issue. I know that you blogged about this in the last couple of days. He said, for decades, some have argued that stability required controlling regimes and that reform and openness would put that stability at risk. So, the argument went, countries like Britain faced a choice between our interests and our values. And to be honest, we should acknowledge that sometimes we have made such calculations in the past. But I say that is a false choice. As recent events have confirmed, denying people their basic rights does not preserve stability, rather the reverse. That's not an excuse, as some would argue, to claim that Arabs or Muslims can't do democracy, the so-called Arab exception. For me, that's a prejudice that borders on racism. It's offensive and wrong and simply not true. Now, of course, a couple of days before that, you'd also blogged that he's over in the Middle East selling arms to a whole bunch of Middle Eastern regimes at the moment, which they will no doubt use to oppress their people in various ways. And, of course, Britain, perhaps even more so than the United States, certainly in the first part of the 20th century, was singularly responsible in conjunction with maybe France of oppressing many of the nations that we now see dictators and oppressive regimes in. Of course, this is the old story of imperialism, which has been around as long as we've been writing history. And it's somewhat hypocritical for Mr. Cameron to say these things while he's selling arms. That said, I haven't heard that kind of transparency and honesty come out of the Obama administration the Gillard administration for that.
The Gillard administration basically gets its orders from Washington. I mean, that's essentially the foreign policy of Australia, sadly. But no, you're absolutely right. I mean, Cameron's speech is quite fascinating in many ways. I mean, the fact that there is arguably a real credibility problem and you're basically giving that speech when you're on a trip selling arms to those dictatorships is a slight problem, you might say.
You got to admire the balls, don't you?
Yes. I mean, there is something, what we call, there is definitely a chutzpah about it, to put it mildly. But I think, on the other hand, look, if someone else was saying it, a lot of what Cameron said clearly is correct, undoubtedly is correct. And the problem, of course, though, is, and the concern is that, is there actually therefore going to be any kind of real sort of change about this? You know, is their policy likely to alter? Are they likely to pull out of Afghanistan, which obviously is an imperial mission? Are they likely to change their posture towards a number of the regimes in the Middle East? I mean, don't forget that although Cameron went to Egypt a few days ago to meet the new rulers, I suspect the conversation wasn't so much, please have an election next week. It was, can we make sure that our British manufacturers and arms dealers can still sell things to you? That's the kind of conversation that goes on. But look, maybe we're being unfair, although I don't think we are. I think Cameron's speech is admirable, and the real test is it going to be put into action? And history would suggest it's not very likely, but we'll wait and see, especially from the Tories, I might add.
Well, I was just going to say that. He's a Conservative Party Prime Minister. We had – this is the topsy-turvy world we live in. We had Blair – arms deep in the Iraq and Afghanistan invasions, the guy from the left, supposedly, and now we have a Tory prime minister actually saying something that sounds true and transparent. It's hard to know which way's up. I want to get back to Libya for a second. You mentioned Robert Fisk, who after you is my second favourite Middle East correspondent.
Oh, God, you're killing me. Well, he's actually over there at the moment, bless him. And he's been doing some bloody wonderful stuff, I have to say.
He is. It's for those of you who don't read Fisk's work, go to the Independent's website and just follow him. He's absolutely marvellous. But
that's great.
He made some, I think, brilliant observations about the situation in Libya today. He said, and if what we are witnessing is a true revolution in Libya, then we shall soon be able, unless the Western embassy flunkies get there first for a spot of serious, desperate looting, to rifle through the Tripoli files and read the Libyan version of Lockerbie and the 1989 UTA Flight 722 plane bombing, and of the Berlin disco bombings, for which a host of Arab civilians and Gaddafi's own adopted daughter were killed in America's 1986 revenge raids, and of his IRA arms supplies, and of his assassination of opponents at home and abroad, and of the murder of a British policewoman, and of his invasion of Chad and the deals with British oil magnates, and, woe betide us all at this point, of the truth behind the grotesque deportation of the soon-to-expire El Megrahi, the supposed Lockerbie bomber too ill to die, who may even now reveal some secrets which the Fox of Libya, along with Gordon Brown and the Attorney General for Scotland, for all are equal on the Gaddafi world stage, would rather we didn't know about. Of course, for those who haven't followed the Lockerbie bombing scandal so much, El Megrahi, who was released from prison after decades, because he was supposedly on death's door, this was, must be a year ago now, and he's still kicking. Of course, there's been conspiracy theories all along that it was really the CIA that blew up Lockerbie, and that there's plenty of evidence to support that, but it didn't get a hearing in the courts. And, of course, I'm sure this happened in Iraq as well. I'm sure there was lots of damaging information on Saddam's relationship with the United States and the UK and probably several other European countries that conveniently disappeared when US troops landed in Iraq. And you've got to bet that the same thing's going to happen in Tripoli.
Well, I mean, your point about the Megrahi case is actually fascinating because I haven't got any, 100% evidence about this, but there are no doubt serious journalists for a number of years have asked serious questions about whether the guy who was in prison for so many years and is now back in Libya, still alive, allegedly, was the actual guy behind it. I don't know the answer to that is a simple answer. A guy called Paul Foote, who's now passed away, a British journalist, did lots of research into this and essentially said that he probably was not. In fact, it was likely to be a Western Intelligence Service job that could be blamed on Libya. I can't remember all the details of that. Suffice to say that it was incredibly convenient, of course, to blame Libya. Libya, of course, was seen as a nation that was a pariah and therefore could be punished for behaving badly. The deal that was struck a few years ago when Megrahi was sent back to Libya has now emerged through WikiLeaks, that wonderful, wonderful website, which revealed, people thought this, but now it was confirmed, and in fact there were attempts to release Megrahi to ensure British business deals in Libya to sort of smooth that over by his release, because Libyans are upset that the British he was still in England and they want to get him back, et cetera, et cetera. So I think what really becomes very clear is, and I hope Fisk is right, that this sort of information gets revealed if Gaddafi falls. But at the same time, the truth is that when it came to Iraq, as you said, there are a great deal of files that were lost during the invasion, that were destroyed during the invasion. I note in the last few days the information we're getting out of Libya, which is pretty sketchy, has shown a lot of offices and buildings being burnt to the ground, the files therefore going down with them. Who knows what the hell is being burnt? Who knows what's going down in flames at the moment? But there's no doubt that I think you will find almost inevitably now, when you seem to have, as we all see, numerous Libyan diplomats now resigning, you do have to ask yourself, what did they think the Gaddafi was doing before this week? I mean, you know, they're all sort of saying, we condemn Gaddafi for these massacres. Well, that's great and that's lovely, but hello, what did you think you were doing representing the regime? I mean, you have to wonder, don't you? Who knows? The human mind does wonderfully weird things, but at the same time, if, you know, good on them for doing so, because frankly, while Gaddafi is still there, they probably do face some sort of potential retaliation, and their families in Libya do as well. So one shouldn't underestimate the risk that they have taken, even though they're diplomats, they might get protection in the countries they're in, including, say, here or anywhere else, but they are taking a risk for doing so. So I'm not minimizing that. I'm simply saying, where have you guys been last years?
It's the old Nuremberg defense.
Yeah.
I was just following orders and I was scared for my life, Your Honor.
Indeed.
Speaking of Western intelligence agencies and diplomatic immunity, we have to talk about what's going on in Pakistan at the moment with this CIA contractor.
Indeed.
That's been caught. This is, you know, one of the great stories. For those people that haven't followed it, there's a gentleman by the name of Davis who's been arrested, 36-year-old former Special Forces soldier. A former CIA contractor, former Blackwater or XE as they're now known contractor, yep, who's apparently been doing some sort of security consulting over in Pakistan. He's been arrested by the Pakistani police. There was some sort of what's referred to as a murky confrontation in Lahore's rush hour traffic on the 27th of January, where Davis apparently shot dead two men. Now, these two men are apparently, there's word coming out that they were Pakistani ISI agents that were tasked to follow him. He's saying it was a botched robbery.
Yeah.
There were also apparently two men who came to his rescue in a Jeep that knocked over and killed a motorcyclist. They've already fled the country, whoever they might have been. Davis claimed to be acting in self-defense, but then it emerged that he shot the men 10 times, including once as he fled the scene, and he was carrying a telescope, a GPS set, bolt cutters, a survival kit, and a long-range radio at the time of his arrest.
As you do, as you do when you just sort of wandering down the street, you know.
But some of the more fascinating points of this is that the Obama administration has said, you've got to release him. He has diplomatic immunity. And Barack Obama even called him our diplomat in Pakistan. Mm. Now, as far as I'm aware, espionage doesn't fall under diplomatic immunity. You don't get to spy on other countries or perform espionage and get covered by the Vienna Convention. So I don't.
However, yes, you are absolutely technically correct. The problem, of course, is that the Pakistan-American relationship isn't what you'd call a normal, healthy relationship. I mean, this has been – I have a number of friends in Pakistan, journalists, et cetera, and I've been in touch with them in the last few days. They're in Lahore and Karachi. And the first thing that needs to be said about this story is, and this is quite common in Pakistan, to actually find out what actually happened, who this guy actually is, what he actually was doing there is close to impossible. However, the reports I think you're referring to came out in The Guardian, I think yesterday, that he was a CIA agent. And that, I might add, was not acknowledged initially at all. He was simply just an American guy there who was a diplomat, which is different to potentially being a senior member of the CIA. Secondly, it emerged on the same time that the New York Times and the American press had the information that he was a CIA agent, but the Obama administration requested the papers not to publish that detail, which, as good little sycophants of the White House, they did, until The Guardian did it for them. And I think, thirdly, it really puts into question what has been happening in this relationship between Pakistan and the US for a long time, which namely is that the Zardari government there does things that they don't want the people to know about, namely assisting America and its so-called counterterrorism program in Pakistan against alleged Taliban, Al-Qaeda elements, et cetera, et cetera. That kind of activity is fundamentally opposed by the vast majority of Pakistani people, namely because the drone attacks that the Obama administration has ramped up hugely, far more drone attacks in the last year and a half since Obama took over than there was during the Bush years, many people don't know that, has killed scores and scores of civilians and, understandably enough, has pissed off a lot of Pakistanis. They don't want Americans kind of running around there seeming like the Wild West, which is exactly what apparently has happened to this guy. He was a CIA spy involved in possibly working with the Pakistanis. Who knows? And this, we shouldn't also forget that the Pakistani state over a number of years, the ISI being the intelligence services there, often has numerous different alliances with America, but also with Taliban, with elements of Al-Qaeda, but also people who oppose them. Very, very complex and murky. And, of course, throughout all this process, as the Pakistan state descends from chaos into anarchy, American aid continues. Military aid continues to go up, not to go down. And you have to really ask ourselves, where is that money actually going? Who is it actually assisting? It's helping the Pakistani people? Clearly not. Not at all. And this is, again, a classic example of US foreign policy in the belief that you can prop up thugs indefinitely to provide some kind of so-called stability or assistance to America or your allies. The opposite is happening. The absolute opposite is happening. Afghanistan's in chaos. The war in Afghanistan was arguably lost years ago. Australia, America, and Britain and many other countries are tragically losing soldiers for no reason whatsoever. The Afghan people clearly are dying on massive scale. And this is being done because I fear, and there's some evidence to back this up, but the Obama administration won't accept the idea that the war is lost. That clearly is an acknowledgement they will not do. So rather than doing that, we'll just keep on fighting and fighting and fighting for who knows how long. Pakistan, of course, is intimately involved with that and supporting that, covertly at least. It's an absolute mess. I think this with this alleged CIA agent, there's no doubt that there are attempts, and this has been shown in previous cases, to both on one level back the Pakistani state but also undermine it as well. There's numerous often contradictory alliances which are very hard to follow. And this sort of stuff is coming from my colleagues in Pakistan who sort of say, we're here, we don't know what the hell is the truth in these stories. We simply don't know. And it's hard to find out for sure, which is, you know, frustrating.
Which is also why we need WikiLeaks.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
And speaking of Pakistan, I don't know if you saw this. It didn't get a lot of coverage in the international media, but a couple of weeks ago, February 12th, report came out that a Pakistani court has issued an arrest warrant for former Pakistani President Musharraf, who was very good friends with George W. Bush.
Indeed.
In connection with the assassination of Benazir Bhutto.
Yeah.
Now, I don't really know where Musharraf is these days. Do you know where he's hiding out?
He's often living quite openly, often lives in Britain.
Uh-huh.
And dare I say, talking about a political comeback in a few years, he wants to make a comeback.
And he's probably playing golf with Mubarak.
Probably. Or David Cameron, who believes in human rights and democracy, yeah.
That's right. Who knows what would be happening in Pakistan with the Pakistani-US relationship today if Benazir Bhutto hadn't been assassinated in 2007. It was very, very convenient, I think, for all parties concerned. But, again, interesting to see what will happen if they actually manage to arrest him and have him deported back. I mean, if they can arrest Julian Assange in England, surely they can arrest Musharraf and have him sent back to Pakistan, you would think.
Except, of course, that Musharraf has got our friends in much higher places than Julian Assange does, unfortunately for Julian. But this case with Musharraf is really interesting in many ways, because the assassination of Bhutto, what, three years ago now, severed what many in the West saw as a possible new beginning with Bhutto winning an election, hopefully, and bringing some kind of that favourite word, stability, back to Pakistan. But the truth is that if anyone knows anything about Bhutto's background history in Pakistan, it ain't that pretty. It ain't pretty in terms of corruption. It ain't pretty in terms of backing the Taliban. It ain't pretty in many areas. And she was liked by many in the Western elites because, A, she spoke their language. I don't just mean English. She spoke English very fluently. But she spoke their language about being friendly to Washington and London's desires. And that sort of thing is how you get in favour, of course, in those capitals. But, look, I think the validity of the allegations against Musharraf are very hard to tell. I mean, there was no one really to this day quite knows exactly who assassinated Bhutto. There's been numerous allegations. Obviously, Musharraf is one of them. The part of the ISI, the Taliban is possible. There was talk about Bhutto just before being assassinated, hiring Blackwater guards to protect her, who didn't do their job very well. They are now, as you said before, called ZXE Enterprises or Services, I think it is. So it's murky, as most things in Pakistan politically seem to be. The idea, though, of getting Musharraf back to Pakistan, you'd have to say not all that likely to stand on trial, I would think. But considering what's happened in the last few months in the Middle East, one always is very wary of predicting anything these days, frankly. I don't see it being that likely. But Musharraf in Pakistan itself is not liked at all. However, whether Zardari, the current leader, is disliked more is really hard to know. I haven't seen the latest opinion polls about that, but there is something, of course. I mean, Pakistan, like a lot of countries, are often ruled by military men. I mean, Zardari is not, he's just a corrupt old fool who is given billions of dollars of aid every year by the Americans and the West to supposedly fight terrorism, but in fact many in his regime, in fact, are supporting the terrorists who are killing people in the first place. And Musharraf did exactly the same thing, and so did Bhutto, for that matter. So one of the things I think that many people in Western policy circles should think about, but of course won't, because, well, why would they think sensibly, is really reassessing the underpinnings of how we in the West view states like Pakistan or Egypt or Libya or Saudi Arabia, for that matter. And we somehow live under the delusion that by backing someone like King Abdullah in Saudi Arabia or Mubarak in Egypt or Musharraf or Zardari in Pakistan, that we are getting protection, so to speak, or we are getting insulated from the problems in those countries. You possibly are protected for a very short amount of time, but the truth is that in the long run, as we're seeing now, the Middle East kind of unraveling from decades of US-backed dictatorships, that so-called stability has helped no one apart from a very few members of the elite who have benefited financially. And whenever we've heard in the last month, for example, about this so-called wonderful stability between Israel and Egypt, if you ask most Egyptians if they benefited from the peace treaty, of course they haven't. I'm not suggesting there should be war between them. Far from it. Have many Palestinians benefited from it? Of course they haven't. So I've sort of said that the words moderate and stability should be wiped from every journalist's tongue and should not be used unless it's used in inverted commas, because stability and moderation are the opposite of what's been happening in that part of the world for a long time.
Which leads me to our last story that we obviously need to talk about very neatly, like you've read the script, of the United Nations Security Council.
Ah, yes.
Had a vote.
That wonderful body with so many teeth, yes.
The Obama administration, well, there was a measure submitted by Lebanon on behalf of the Palestinians to the UNSC on Friday last week, calling the Israeli settlements, the continuing settlement into Palestine, illegal and demanding they be halted immediately. 14 current members of the Security Council, including Britain, Germany and France, all backed the measure. And, of course, the Obama administration exercised for the first time its UN Security Council veto and killed the resolution. And yep. Hamas have come out, as have many other bodies, and called the UN, the US's veto immoral. I remember when Obama came into power, Anthony, he was speaking fairly firmly about Israel's settlements into Palestine and making vaguely threatening noises to Benjamin Netanyahu about what would happen to US support for Israel if they didn't cease the settlements. Netanyahu seems to have given him the finger, and life just goes on as normal. You know, I know that you're a self-hating Jew.
Absolutely. I embrace that every day when I go to sleep.
Like, you know, Noam Chomsky and Larry David before you. Why do you think the Obama administration has talked tough and then, you know, backed down?
Well, Obama, like so many areas, is a lovely speaker but doesn't actually put action into words into action. I mean, you saw, as you rightly said, even during the campaign in 2008, a few comments that Obama made about settlements and et cetera, et cetera. He came in and made some other stronger statements that settlements were illegal, they had to be removed. But the truth is that this is a – without some kind of real pressure – diplomatic pressure, in my view, there should be a serious threat of withdrawing US aid to Israel, which is to me the only way it's ever going to change. As you rightly said, Israel gave America the finger and then America backed down. And this, I think, is for two main reasons. One, because of an incredibly powerful Israel lobby or Zionist lobby in the US. Domestically speaking, what the lobby has done very effectively for a long time, this is across Democratic and Republican lines, is to give they basically put both pressure and also support to individuals who believe somehow that anything other than uncritical support for Israel is tantamount to wanting to kill all Jews. I mean, if you listen to a lot of the discussion of Democrats and Republicans, and with a few exceptions, this is pretty uniform. There is little or no mainstream discussion in the US, in the US Congress, with a few exceptions, talking about what Israel is doing is utterly, A, illegal under international law, but is also totally and utterly opposed to what America supposedly says they believe in the Middle East. And, of course, the great irony is in the last month or so, as the Middle East is imploding around America's head in a beautifully beautiful way, there is a sense that, and many American politicians have said this, this is even more reason why we should be backing Israel even stronger, even more reason, because Israel is reliable, the regime's not about to fall, it's not about to be controlled by crazy Muslims, that's not what I'm saying, that's what they're saying. We should support Israel even more, more funding, more money, more backing. Now, the Obama administration has made a number of comments over the last year and a half, settlements are bad. I mean, even after this UN resolution a few days ago, Hillary Clinton said, no, no, we're definitely opposed to settlements. Well, what are you going to do about it? I mean, you know, they've been opposed to settlements since 1967. And here we are 40-odd years later, 43 years later, 4 years later, and there are 500,000 Jews illegally on Palestinian land. Now, of course, the great irony about this, again, is that the stated position of America, Australia, Britain, much of the West is a two-state solution, Palestinian state, Jewish Israeli state. The reality is the two-state solution is dead, buried, done, finished. Arguably, it was never going to happen practically, but now it's impossible to happen in a viable way. So the great irony is by allowing and indulging Israel to continue building settlements, and we shouldn't forget, of course, there's also massive discrimination within Israel itself towards Israeli Arabs, and indeed a growing – it's more than an intolerance towards dissent in Israel. There are growing – and the word has to be used – fascist politicians in the mainstream political parties, not on the fringes, in the mainstream, who are calling for – serious punishment for those who are critical of Israel, the IDF, etc. Punishing of Palestinians who are critical, expulsion of Israeli Arabs, mainstream rabbis talking about legitimizing the killing of Palestinians and Arabs who are enemies of Jews. And this is what Israel is, you know. And whenever I hear Kevin Rudd, who I might add, in December last year, led the biggest delegation Australia's ever sent to Israel, the biggest ever. There were about 18 people, politicians and a lot of mainstream journalists who went. And the truth is that there is a profound disconnect between those politicians and journalists who all come back pretty much to a man or woman talking about the glories of democracy and freedom and human rights in Israel, all that bullshit. And at the same time, somehow not understanding the fact that by their actions, by being uncritical and allowing Israel to behave as it does, they actually are contributing to the end of the Jewish state, because we're getting to a point very soon, I don't know when, but in the next 5 years, 10 years, 15 years, where the sheer number of Palestinians are going to outnumber Jews. This is where we're moving. And that is by definition an apartheid state. It's an apartheid state now, frankly, and that's a legal opinion rather than a personal opinion. But the idea of having a majority of Palestinians being ruled over a minority of Jews, that's basically what we're getting to. And it seems to me remarkable that the US, despite what's happened in the last month, continues to support Israel, not recognizing so clearly that the image of Washington already in the Middle East could not be lower. By doing that, supporting Israel blindly in the UN, that's actually just contributed to that image getting even worse. So on the one hand, one has to kind of laugh and sort of say, Israel, America in many ways is signing Israel's death warrant. But at the same time, the fear is that as Israel becomes more and more of a ghettoized state, a militarized ghetto state, it's essentially turning itself into a fortress funded, backed by the US, that it's likely to lash out and do crazy things like reinvade Lebanon or reinvade Gaza or something like that.
Or nuke Iran.
Well, yes. I mean, an attack on Iran is the elephant in the room here. I mean, a lot of people said in the last week, some of the commentary has been that Mubarak's Egypt was a key supporter of Israel doing something against Iran. Now, clearly and hopefully the regime in Egypt, well, at the moment it's the same regime, but hopefully the regime itself changes, that it's unlikely, you'd hope, to be as supportive of that. An attack on Iran by Israel or America would be a catastrophe. And if people in the West believe in supporting, as I do, those who are bravely protesting in the streets of Tehran and elsewhere and being mowed down by the thugs of the Iranian state, by bombing Iran, those people suddenly become utterly irrelevant. And a lot of my Iranian friends say even those who vehemently hate the regime would rally around it, because the last thing they will accept is a bombing campaign by America or Israel, and damn right, they shouldn't accept that.
But it's been even, they've already been attacking Iran and perhaps in even more dangerous ways. You know, it was a few months ago that word started to come out that an Iranian nuclear facility had been hacked by some sort of computer virus that seems to have come out of Israel. I mean, God knows what the potential consequences of something like that could have been. They're messing around with cyber warfare in Iran, messing around with nuclear facilities. I mean, that kind of stuff scares the shit out of me, quite frankly.
Well, you're talking about Stuxnet, which was this sort of virus that was designed probably in Israel, probably in America. We don't exactly know, partly in Europe, to essentially disable Iran's nuclear capability. Now, again, we don't know all the full details of that, but the information is sort of been leaking out here and there in various different sources, and it appears that Iran's nuclear capability has been affected negatively by it. It slowed down their ability to process uranium. And, of course, the unknown factor in all this is somehow that and I think Chomsky says this very, very well, that when it comes to a country like Iran, although we often hear about this threat of nuclear weapons, the truth is that this is not about nuclear weapons whatsoever. Not at all. This is truly about the idea that a state like Iran is giving the finger to America and is independent. This doesn't justify for a second how Iran behaves. Iran is a thug state run by complete thugs. There's no question about that at all. But what the main propaganda in the West against Iran. It's not really about human rights. It's couched in the language of human rights and a deep concern about those poor Iranians who are being mowed down in the streets of Tehran. That's not what this is about. This is about a regime in Tehran which dares to not accept the narrative or a view put forward in the Middle East by America and Israel, because for, frankly, decades, Israel and America have essentially ruled the Middle East. And Iran challenges that hegemony. And, of course, the greatest irony of ironies is, why has that happened? Because of the Iraq War. The Iraq War has allowed Iran to become a major player in that region. Iran is now incredibly close to Iraq after many years of being, shall we say, not very fond, had a massive war, millions killed. The leaders of Iraq now, Maliki and others, are incredibly close to Iran. They visit Tehran regularly. This is the wonderful gift that America has given the Middle East. I mean, it's unbelievable. It's unbelievable. And the idea of bombing Iran or attacking its nuclear facilities would only make that situation worse. And, you know, I mean, Ahmadinejad, I'm no defender of Ahmadinejad. As I said, I've written about him for years, and he's an ignorant anti-Semitic fool. But his regime is not stupid, and they are aware of the fact that although they're something under pressure now economically, the sanctions that America and the UN have imposed are definitely having an economic effect. And it's very hard to tell really how much support opposition groups have in Iran. There's obviously no effective polling. There clearly is either a very vocal minority or a sizable percentage of the population who dislike the regime. But is it a majority? I really don't know the answer, and no one does. But clearly, it was pretty inspiring, I have to say, in the last week to see masses of Iranians protesting when they did that last time about a year and a half ago. A lot of them were massacred, arrested, tortured, and raped in prison. And so to mess with that kind of regime takes a lot of guts.
It does, and I, whilst I think the two regimes are quite different, I often get a sense that the people of Iran and the people of Cuba perhaps have a lot in common in that they're not necessarily happy about how they live or the regime that they live under, but the fact that that regime has the audacity to give the finger to the United States gives them a certain amount of gathers them a certain amount of respect.
It does, in a way. I think yes, for some, but of course we shouldn't forget that in, for example, a lot of the people I know in Iran, this is more the educated middle class. A lot of them, if they can leave Iran, they're leaving or they've left, and you really can't blame them. Life in Iran is tough. They want opportunities. They want to have a good job. They want to live lives where they can, you know, speak their mind. Obviously not all Iranians have left Iran. Millions of them are still there. But a lot of Iranians in the last years, especially in the last 3 or 4 years, including many friends that I know, and these are not mega wealthy people. Obviously, they have a bit of money. They're middle class, but they're not, you know, massively wealthy. They've left. And they've left family and friends there, but they've left because life is very difficult there. So do they, you know, is it important to them that Tehran's giving America the finger? Yes, to an extent, but that wasn't enough for them to stay, you know.
They want to go back to Iran pre-1953 when the US overthrew Mossadegh. Before that, Iran, from the accounts that I've read, was a fairly civilized country with, you know, lots of opportunity and wealth and
yeah, I mean,
democracy.
Many would love to return, but I was speaking to a friend a few days ago who's now living in London. He works for BBC Persia, he can't go back. Now, he can't go back because he fears that if he did, he'd be in prison, and that could last for years. I mean, this guy's like 27, 28. Now, he has family in Tehran. I mean, can he return in a year, 5 years, 20 years? Who knows?
We've got to point out, though, that Iran was a basket case well before the Ayatollah Khomeini and the Islamic Revolution.
Under the Shah, it was a police state backed by the West, absolutely.
Backed by the US, put into power by the US, backed by the supported, just like, you know, these other guys we've been talking about, with massive amounts of funds and military training and support and personnel for decades, an absolutely corrupt and violent police state. that was engineered by the United States and England. You know, it was England who went to the US to ask him to overthrow Mossadegh in the first place because he wanted to privatize the British oil interests. Anyway. Anthony, thanks for taking the time to chat with us. Obviously, with all the stuff going on over there, we should have you on a more regular basis. So will you?
My pleasure. It was good. Thank you for the opportunity. I appreciate it.
Thank you, mate. Be well. Keep up the great work.
Speak to you soon. You too. Bye.